News Today, brought to you by Admiral Corporation in behalf of Admiral distributors and dealers all over America and in many foreign lands. By shortwave broadcast direct from important overseas stations and leading news centers in our own country, CBS reporters are waiting to bring you first-hand news from the world's political and battlefronts. Now, here's Douglas Edwards.
A United Press dispatch reported a few minutes ago that Allied troops have cleared the key city of Breda in southwestern Holland of all enemy forces except a few scattered snipers, and the Germans are retreating across the Maas River. This morning, strong groups of British and American bombers flew over Sweden, apparently en route to give aid to the Finnish and Russian troops in northern Finland. The Germans say four Soviet armies have begun a large-scale offensive in Latvia, and Berlin Radio claims the Allies have landed on the Greek island of Melos in the Aegean. And now for news from the headquarters of our Pacific Fleet and an interview with the first wave to arrive in Honolulu, Admiral takes you to CBS Pearl Harbor. Webley Edwards reporting.
Fleet headquarters is readying a report on the second battle of the Philippine Sea. But at this hour, the details are still in the mill, we say. All report coming from the battle area, however, indicate that this naval battle was a blazing, thundering affair. And it is definitely certain that the United States forces were victorious, that the Japanese were routed, broken, and badly defeated. During the high activity here at Fleet Headquarters these past eventful days have been some very interested and very busy officers of the Navy's Women's Reserve. One of them, Lieutenant Commander Joy Bright Hancock of Wildwood, New Jersey, is our guest for a brief minute. Commander Hancock, this is an exciting time to be here.
Indeed it is. I've known and watched many of those boys out there while they were growing their wings back home.
I understand you are one of the two waves wearing the first World War ribbon. You were a yeomanette then, right?
That's correct.
Was I in order calling you a wave?
Yes.
Officially, it's Women's Reserve. And what is your title?
Got your breath?
Yep.
Women's Reserve Representative for the Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Air and the Bureau of Aeronautics.
Well, I got that every word. Now, you're here, Commander Hancock, and Lieutenant Commander Gene Palmer, to survey needs and facilities for the first waves out in this part of the world. When may we expect them, by the way?
A few of the first officers will arrive soon. We hope the enlisted personnel will begin arriving in December. As you know, only those who request overseas duty will be given consideration for services out here.
They'll relieve enlisted men?
More than that, the waves will in general be new personnel to fill new jobs created by increasing duties in this area. They will be assigned to all activities that can use them, shore establishments first, such as control tower operators, aviation machinist mates, supply corps, and so on.
And the waves have already contributed much toward winning the war by their work on the mainland, Commander. I know that everyone out here is well pleased that they'll be extending their activities out into the Pacific.
We hope so, and every wave will do her utmost. You may be sure of that.
You've heard Lieutenant Commander Joy Bright Hancock of the Women's Reserve, United States Navy. And thank you, Commander. This is Webley Edwards at Fleet Headquarters in Pearl Harbor.
And this is Phil Woodyatt in San Francisco. No job seems too hopeless for Tokyo Radio to tackle. These past few days, Japan's propagandists have been trying to turn a trick which would make even Dr. Goebbels turn pale with anxiety. Tokyo's claims of a fabulous naval victory off the Philippines were cooked up largely to boost the sagging morale on the Japanese home front. And according to Tokyo, the factories really hummed for a while. But the Jap leaders are now in a bad spot. To avoid being exposed for the blatant liars they are, they've got to say something like this to the people at home. "We won a glorious victory in this naval battle," they say, "and we destroyed most of the American fleet. But the war situation is even more serious than it was before. The Americans," they say, "will soon replace the lost fleet." Perhaps the precision-trained Japanese people can follow their leaders through this painful hodgepodge, but you'd think that the present crisis in the Tokyo cabinet would be a dead giveaway. You'll recall that General Tojo was finished off as prime minister by the American conquest of Saipan. And now General Koiso, The present prime minister has been all but finished off by the Japanese defeats in and around the Philippines. Here's what happened. As soon as the full story of Japan's losses became known, a group of Japanese leaders, dressed in the traditional top hats and cutaway coats, called on His Majesty the Emperor. Prime Minister Koiso was not among them. When they came out, Koiso found that he had an even dozen of new advisors, each with the rank of minister. And Tokyo says that these men will have the power to advise not only on economic matters, but on material and spiritual matters as well, which just about covers everything. Both Tojo and Koiso are men of the Kwantung Army, that powerful group of militarists who rule Manchuria and who also ruled Japan in Tojo's day. But no Kwantung leaders are in this new board of advisors. In fact, the only army officer in the lot is a harmless, retired, 80-year-old general. As for the rest, there's one old admiral, four industrialists, a couple of politicians, a banker, a farm expert, a university president, and a newspaper publisher. These are the new leaders of Japan. It's clear that with nothing to its credit but a series of defeats, which have been getting worse and worse, the Kwantung group is just about all washed up in Tokyo. But this doesn't mean that all these civilians are a peace group. The powers they represent have been trying to push into the government ever since Pearl Harbor, and they didn't like Tojo's one-man army rule. Tojo's defeat at Saipan let some of them in. Koiso's defeat in the Philippines has pushed the door wide open. Japan will simply try a new system now. Tokyo calls it a rejuvenation of the government. These new rulers will try very hard to fight the war better. And they'll try to keep everybody happy by giving all groups a voice in the cabinet. But about the only thing to keep them in for long would be the destruction of the Allied navies. And that's not like to happen. I return you to Admiral in New York.
News from Europe in just a moment. But first, here's Warren Sweeney with a message from Admiral Corporation.
Perhaps you've wondered why Admiral Radio is called America's Smart Set. Well, one of the very good reasons is the smart styling and lasting beauty that have always been a tradition in building Admiral cabinets. The performance of Admiral radios has always been smartly up-to-date and very often ahead of the field because of the long list of Admiral firsts. When you see all of the after-victory Admiral models, the consoles and table models, the farm sets and portables, the bantams and the various models of radio phonographs with automatic record changers, when you learn about Admiral's FM, television, and home recording, you're going to agree that any one of these grand radios is indeed America's smart set. Admiral Corporation is the world's largest manufacturer of radio phonographs with automatic record changers. This fact alone is convincing proof of Admiral's nationwide popularity. Post-war, Admiral will be prepared to give America an improved radio phonograph with a revolutionary new automatic record changer that is destined to make music appreciation history. Yes, you can rest assured that intelligent buyers, those quality and value-conscious people all over America, will again choose Admiral Radio, America's smart set. Now, here once again is Douglas Edwards.
And for a summary of developments on the Western Front, Admiral takes you to Paris. Larry Lesser reporting.
The weather was a lot better over the Western Front today, and the break in the weather came at a good time for us. Swarms of Allied fighter bombers took to the air to help the British and Canadian drive against the crumbling German defenses north of Antwerp. British troops fighting north of Antwerp over the soggy bogs of Holland are driving the Germans back from one position to another. But the Germans are fighting back bitterly to avoid being pinned down against the almost bridgeless River Mouth. The enemy has left a good-sized pocket of troops to fight a rearguard action between Kantorgenbosch and Tilburg. There's no sign of a planned German withdrawal, but they're being battered from pillar to post. The position of this rearguard pocket shows that the Germans still hope to swing their front back to the River Mouth and thus avoid being cut to pieces before they can get there. It's obvious that the Germans fear the British drive in Holland will irretrievably break the blockade of the port of Antwerp. Indications of these fears came in four spirited German counterattacks launched in the past 3 days from the other side of the battlefield, the east, against the troops protecting the British eastern flank. A German battle group of some 500 men, supported by 30 or so tanks, made a powerful surge across the canal north of Maestricht and drove the Allied troops back up to 1,500 yards in some places on a 10-mile front. A funny thing, one of the German counterblows sprang from the vicinity of a little Dutch town called America. It's clear the purpose of these heavy German counterattacks is to divert reinforcements away from the successfully driving British troops on the opposite side of the big salient in Holland. Meanwhile, the Allied air effort to break all German railroad communications in the Ruhr and Rhineland was carried on with increased determination today. American Thunderbolt bombers flew all the way into the eastern Ruhr to bomb the railroads. Others smashed a railroad bridge in the Cologne Plain between Düren and the shattered city of Cologne. And returning pilots reported that Cologne is still burning after our recent overwhelming air raid. This is Larry LeSueur returning now to Admiral in New York.
For a direct report from the American First Army front, Admiral takes you to Belgium. Ned Kalmer reporting.
This is a story that typifies the situation behind the American lines in Germany today. It's a story that has its humorous as well as serious aspect. You might entitle it, A Town in Search of a Mayor. For more than a week now, the city of Aachen has been officially in American hands. All resistance has ceased, and the defending garrison has formally surrendered. The battle lines have moved eastward beyond the city. What fighting there is during this period of lull is taking place well outside, and nobody in his right mind would bet that Aachen will ever be recaptured by the Nazi high command. Nevertheless, it's been impossible so far to find a citizen of Aachen who's willing to become mayor of the newly occupied city, the mayor of the first sizable German city under Allied occupation. Our military authorities have been trying hard to locate somebody fitted for the post who's willing to accept it. A number of candidates have been offered the chance to qualify, but they don't want the job. And though some of them are less articulate than others, the general drift of their remarks is clear. Nazism, the Nazi regime, still holds a strong and sinister sway over the occupied portion of Germany, even though that influence was exercised, so to speak, by remote control. German civilians will cooperate with us as long as it's more or less unofficial cooperation. But apparently, they have as yet no leader willing to risk the torturing or death of his relatives by becoming the first non-Nazi mayor of a German city. So we're bound to keep on calling till we find one. This is Ned Kalmer with the American First Army. Returning you now to Admiral in New York.
For additional news on Britain and the Battle of Europe, Admiral takes you to CBS London. Eric Severide reporting.
Today, London's press gives great headlines to the story of General Stilwell's recall from China. So far, there is no attempt at explanation. Real knowledge here of the problem in China is confined to a small circle. There has never been, in England, the same emotional feeling about China there was in America. There has never been any real indication from the British government that it believed China could contribute very much to the defeat of Japan and was therefore worth a serious reinforcement effort. That effort has been American. And it was obvious in Chungking that Stilwell was a driving force behind it. He struggled relentlessly. He had to work with men to whom form, face, and favor were everything. And for that, he had no time. Whatever his quarrels with Chinese leaders, and they are not a new development, there were many intelligent Chinese there who looked upon him as their country's greatest friend. For he believed two things passionately, that Japan must be defeated on the soil of China, and that the Chinese army, despite its state of inefficiency, could be hammered into an effective fighting force. That was his mission and his dream. Yet he found himself in a position where every military proposal had to be considered by the Chinese in the light of its political effect upon the status of the Chinese communists or this provincial governor or that local warlord. Stilwell is simple and direct, not only in speech but in action. and it is impossible to move in straight lines when you find yourself in a labyrinth. Very little of the complex China story is known to the British people, perhaps not so much more to Americans. But nearly all Americans in China, both military and civilian, did believe that the whole situation should have been explained long ago. Some reporters, including this one, have tried. They found themselves censored and stopped by the War Department in Washington for what it believed were considerations of military security, by the State Department for what it called diplomatic reasons. In most battle theaters, Allied leaders have the comfort of knowing that their people at home have some appreciation of their problems. Those leaders in China have not. This is Eric Severide in London. I return you now to Admiral.
It's still a very slow and very tough fight on the Italian battlefields. For a summary of the latest developments, Admiral takes you to CBS Rome, Farnsworth Fowle reporting.
The Italian front has been under the influence of bad weather, and there isn't much change to report. The Canadians have moved ahead a bit on the west coast. The Brazilians on the west coast. The American advance elements have been withdrawn from what are called exposed positions on Mount Mazzano. The Air Force was mostly grounded again. Some light bombers crossed the Adriatic to attack shipping on the Dalmatian coast. They had to drop their bombs through the clouds. A small force of B-17s went to Klagenfurt in Austria to bomb an aircraft factory. It was the same story there. But late yesterday afternoon, the weather cleared over northwestern Italy, and P-47 fighter bombers made the most of their opportunity, claiming 17 locomotives, 33 cars, and 36 motor vehicles destroyed. That's a pretty good average for only 65 sorties. The British, moving north in Greece, have pushed their way along the highway where it swings inland past Mount Olympus of the Gods. Advancing 60 miles northwest from Larissa, they've brought artillery to bear on the German rear guards in Kozani. The big port of Salonika is 70 miles away to the northeast, and the frontier of Yugoslavia is only 40 miles north of Kozani. By the sound of it, the British have crossed the river Aliakmon and have entered that traditional Balkan no-man's land, Macedonia. It isn't really a country or a nationality. Greek Macedonia is pretty thoroughly Greek by this time. But further north, across the border of Yugoslavia, Serbian and Bulgarian influence have been at odds for 60 years. It looks as though the first junction of British and Red Army ground forces would take place in this area.
That was Farnsworth Fowle in Rome. And now for an interview with the chief of the field service, Army Ordnance, just back from a 20,000-mile trip in the Pacific, Admiral takes you to CBS Washington, Joe McCaffrey reporting.
When giving credit to our forces fighting in all parts of the world, there may sometimes be a tendency to overlook the work which is done by the service units of the Army. One such valuable organization is the Army Ordnance. Today as our guest, we have the man who took Detroit to the fighting fronts, a man who is in charge of one of the largest assembly lines with headquarters in such out-of-the-way places as jungles and battle-scarred Pacific Islands. Incidentally, although this man today is an officer in the United States Army, he is a graduate of the United States Naval Academy. He is Brigadier General Julian S. Hatcher, Chief of Field Service for the Army Ordnance. The general has just returned from a 20,000-mile inspection trip of Ordnance field installations in the Pacific, including those which were our farthest west before General MacArthur's troops invaded the Philippines. On this trip, General Hatcher had an excellent opportunity to see firsthand the work of our ordnance soldiers under rugged battle conditions. But first, General, I understand that you did a little investigating of Japanese propaganda over there, too.
Yes, I found that the Japanese soldier in this war thinks he is fighting in Texas and California. Those captured Japanese I talked to all think they were defeated in Texas, but they defiantly claim other Japanese are carrying on victoriously in California. No matter what the island is, the Jap soldier apparently is told that it is part of the United States, almost always Texas. This conviction of the enemy soldier struck me as one of the most amazing evidences of propaganda used by the Japanese to indoctrinate their fighting men. It doesn't make sense, but neither does their fanatical willingness to commit suicide rather than be captured when they are cornered by our forces.
I understand that you found the ordnance men have devised a way to make the enemy feel his own steel.
Yes, we found that the Japanese 81-millimeter mortar shell will fit our mortars. It is not as good a shell as ours, but it fits perfectly. Now, every time our forces come on an ammunition dump which contains these shells, they send them right back to the Japs.
Suppose you tell us about the work of ordnance as you observed it in the battle zones, General.
Our men go right in with the assault forces when they land in order to keep the guns in firing conditions. and the tanks which arrive in the early waves moving towards the objectives. But what impressed me most is how the big ordnance bases move ahead as we move closer to Japan. When we see the islands further west, we move every bit of army material off the islands in the rear areas and bring them to the new front. Every piece of lumber, every shed, every tool, to have them at the actual scene of operations.
What does this repair work consist of?
We make use of every tire that can possibly be saved, for instance. We have large, well-equipped tire shops which retread and rebuild tires damaged in battle. Our trucks are shipped, crated, and stripped down in order to conserve valuable shipping space. Therefore, we have assembly lines fashioned after the time-saving devices used in industry. Uncrating is done by machinery, and in a matter of minutes, the parts are unpacked and sent along our wilderness assembly line to be put together. After that, they are tested before being sent to the troops.
In the present Philippine invasion, General, how are the repairs carried out?
Right now, on Leyte Island, ordnance supplies are going ashore and establishment of our big ordnance bases is underway. But before they are completed, all the work that can be done will be done by small groups of men working with whatever tools and spare parts they are able to carry on their persons or in small trucks. The bigger jobs will be left for the repair bases to take care of when they are completely supplied with new parts and machinery.
This on-the-spot repair work must be paying dividends.
It is. First of all, it saves valuable shipping space, for every tank, gun, or truck we can put back in Class A condition is one less that will have to be brought to the scene by ship, thus leaving room for food and other supplies and equipment. Then, too, it makes for greater efficiency for our fighting forces and helps pay off in lives saved. All this, plus the fact it saves money.
You have seen the enemy's equipment at the scene of battle. How does it stack up with ours?
We can't underestimate the Japanese equipment, but ours is much superior. That is why we're able to repair and salvage so much of it. Our men and women on the production line are doing an excellent job, and if they could see the results of their work after it has been through combat, they would, I'm sure, feel a deep sense of pride.
You have just heard Brigadier General Julian S. Hatcher, Chief of Field Service for the Army Ordnance. This is Joe McCaffrey in Washington. I return you to Admiral in New York.
Here's a bulletin just in from headquarters of the 1st Canadian Army in Holland. American troops are now fighting under 1st Canadian Army command. They've captured several villages, and all of Breda except the northern portion has been cleared by Polish troops. A Berlin broadcast announced the evacuation of the communications hub of Oche, 34 miles southwest of Jelgava in Latvia today. That stands on a main rail line between Riga, Jelgava, and the Baltic port of Liepāja and controls roads running westward. But when Latvia is finally cleaned up, the Russians will accomplish three things: removal of a threat to their flank as they drive on East Prussia, release of a considerable number of divisions for employment against East Prussia or elsewhere, and a very considerable shortening of their front, thus simplifying their supply and transport situation. And now, once again, here is Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral.
Maybe you think you've seen some attractive kitchen stoves, but you haven't seen anything until you viewed the newly styled, gleaming white and chromium beauty of the post-war Admiral electric ranges. There's an old saying that beauty is only skin deep. Well, there are so many exclusive features built right into the new Admiral electric ranges that you will quickly agree their beauty goes all the way through. But you'll have to see them to appreciate them. Take, for example, the Admiral five-way timer. This miraculous timer is simply beautiful in its operation. It makes automatically time cooking possible in the oven, in the complete meal cooker, the surface units, or the cooker and one surface unit in combination. You can automatically time any appliance, too, such as a coffee pot that you plug into the convenience outlet. No timer has ever been so easy and so simple to set as the Admiral five-way timer. We know that most of you will agree to the many advantages of electric cookery, such as cleanliness, coolness, convenience, speed, safety, economy, and healthfulness. You know it's the modern method of meal preparation. And practically everyone knows of the leadership of Admiral Radio, America's smart set. So when you see the beauty and years ahead features of the Admiral electric ranges, you'll agree that Admiral has done it again. It's another Admiral first. We should all buy more and more war bonds and hold them. True, the war news from all fronts has been good. But the more our armies are on the offensive, the greater the need for the supplies that our war bonds buy. Not one of us can slacken our efforts now. Let's buy them and hold them till the job is done. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by Admiral Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's Smart Set, and post-war makers of Admiral Dual Temp Refrigerators, Admiral Home Freezers, Admiral Electric Ranges. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you World News Today by shortwave, direct from leading news centers of the world. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
This is the WBBM Air Theater, Wrigley Building, Chicago 11.